Good morning, 10 a.m. this Wednesday morning, and you know, usually on Wednesdays we have that funky old Kenai Conversation intro music. Darned if we can find that CD. So hey, the old standby, Dave Brubeck, bringing us in this morning for the Kenai Conversation. And this week, we're going to the birds, folks. The Kenai Birding Festival, 14th annual Kenai Birding Festival, is happening this weekend on the Kenai Peninsula, and this is a fun show we like to do every year. And as we've done for many years in the past, we have in the studio with us Mr. Toby Burke is joining us this morning. Good morning, Toby. Thanks so much for coming in today.
And thank you for inviting us.
You bet, you bet. Always great to have you on. And just a brief mention. Typically, we invite Ken Tarbox is with us usually for this program and to talk a little bit about the Birding Festival. And sorry that Ken couldn't be with us this morning, but know that he's still very much involved in this year's festival, and we'll hope to see him out there this weekend and hoping for the best for Ken. But we want to talk a lot about what's going on this weekend, because as with every year at the Kenai Birding Festival, there's just a ton going on. And as we get into this conversation, as we get into this hour, of course, we would love to have you jump in on the conversation as well. 283-8414. If you have some questions about what's happening this weekend during the Kenai Birding Festival, if you have, maybe you're a birder yourself, you've got some stories you'd like to tell, some tips, some tricks, some things that you would like to share with folks, or questions for Toby, who we're going to get into some of his lists and some of the things that he's developed to help folks in their birding activities here on the Kenai Peninsula. That's going to be a big portion of the show. Again, 283-8414 if you would like to get in on the conversation. And I did want to start, Toby, with let's kind of go over a little bit of a rundown of what's going to be going on with the Birding Festival this week. And of course, things kicking off, well, kind of kicking off today. I know the Peeps Art Show is always a part of this, and that's on display, opens up today, and will be on display at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center through the weekend, right?
Right, right.
And yeah, what else is happening as we get stuff kicked off on Thursday?
Okay, well, of course, like I said, our festival is a four-day festival, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And all 4 days, we have a full slate, especially the first 3 days. Thursday, we kick off with the Kenai River Float Trip, which personally is my favorite event, you know, and I've been able to participate every year on that. And that's a great event. We usually launch from the Kenai Lower Boat Launch, and we float down about 12 or 13 miles all the way down to Bing's Landing. Mm-hmm. And we usually have anywhere from 3 to 5 boats, depending on how many people sign up. And I think this year we'll have 3 or 4 boats.
Is it? And it's full up by now,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. It's full up. And and generally speaking on that, I guess we usually are out on the river for maybe like 6 hours or so. And usually within that time, we usually scare up 60 to 70 species right there along the river just from the boat. Not beating the brush, but just floating down the river, passively birding. And we see a great section of the river.
I had an opportunity some years ago there just happened to open up a spot like that morning, and I was lucky to answer the phone right at that moment and got a seat. And it was just a beautiful, gorgeous bluebird day, pardon the pun, a gorgeous day to float down the river. And this is one of my favorite things that I tell this to folks a lot, is one of the best pieces of audio I've ever gotten as a radio reporter is floating down the river, and in the boat just a couple of feet away floating down next to us, and we hear a loon right there, which is a very distinctive and memorable sound. And a woman in the boat next to me, you could just, the greatest piece of tape I've ever gotten was her, that was all she wanted to hear. She could die a happy woman at that point. She had heard her loon and she was just ecstatic about it. And that float trip, when you get to see those kinds of reactions, it's a lot of fun down there.
Yeah, and another thing that some people might forget is when we do this float trip, it's really before the fishing season begins. So when we float the river through the refuge and then the lower part of the, you know, where there's private lands, the river is deserted. It's all to us. We're not encountering any fishermen. We seldom encounter any other boat. And it's just a wonderful experience. And for a lot of people who lived here, I don't think most people have even been out on the river when they haven't seen other boats or other fishing boats. So we're not dealing with any traffic. It's just quiet and birds.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic experience, and it does, it sells out pretty quick. Those seats are taken up in a pretty rapid pace every year.
Yes, I mean, we've had some years where it is sold out in hours, and which has made a lot of people unhappy. Like, how am I going to get a seat? But generally speaking, if you're persistent, you know, you can get a seat. And not only that, but as we'll talk about later, we've opened up another float trip opportunity.
Okay, so. Well, let's keep going down the list. That's the Kenai River float trip that's coming up tomorrow to kind of kick off some of the big events for the Birding Festival, and then looks like another opportunity a bit closer to town there.
Yeah, and we have the Centennial Park Bird Walk. That's at 8. And you don't have to sign up ahead of time. You can just show up there. So if you say, "Oh, I missed out on the float trip," the Centennial Park Centennial Park Walk, and they're going to meet right at the Soldotna.
Right at the boat launch there at Centennial Park.
No, actually, they're going to meet at the recreational center.
Okay.
And
now, is that a tour guided?
Yes.
Sort of. Okay.
Yes, there'll be two our local experts. Okay. Georgia and Bev Kirsch, and. They're very passionate about that area. They know every little bird and where it dwells. And if there's birds to be found there, they will find them. But it's a rich little area, and it's right in town. And that walk will start it at 8 and may go as long as 11. But like I said, it's the type of walk you're not obligated to stay mm-hmm. longer than you want. You know, there's always opportunities for you to circle back and go back to your car.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great opportunity to bird with people who can identify those birds that you have trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that I want to get into a little bit later in the program as well. Is maybe I'm sure you'll have some tips and some tricks and things for folks if they've never been out to kind of keep in mind and things like that. And then for the festival introduction, anything big going on there?
Again, that's the festival introduction. The formal introduction will be Thursday evening at 6:30, and it'll go to about 7:45 p.m. and that'll be at the Kenai Visitor Center, Cultural and Visitor Center there in Kenai. And they'll be, obviously, at that introduction, they'll be talking about opportunities to all the different events and maybe answer questions of people who want to know more about what events that they might pique their interest. And there's also some fun things. We kind of do a bird trivia. Now, listen, you don't have to be knowledgeable about birds because we form teams, and you'll form a round table team, and sometimes you'll have four or five people on a team, and it really is fun. So even if you don't think you know something, it's really not just a trivia game for experts, because there's a lot of offbeat questions, and it's really
sort of
loosely fun.
Based around the birding world.
So you don't have to be a bird expert. In fact, it's the type of game where you might beat the bird experts. So, but we've done it in the past, and it really is a lot of fun. It was one of those things where I first participated and said, you know, gosh, this is really fun, you know.
It is a lot of fun. That's something that's sort of about birding in general that, as I've had conversation with folks and gone on a few walks over the years and this sort of thing, birding is something that there can be sort of a level of competition to it, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. It's kind of at your own pace, but at the same time, you do want to see things maybe in a place where no one else has seen them. You do want to catch a glimpse of something it's a tough thing to do. It's some catching some of these more rare species is a little bit of hard work sometimes.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because birding is it's a different animal for different people.
Right.
And a lot of times it's like most things, there's an evolution. I know for a lot of people at first, it's just about seeing new forms of life, beautiful forms,
mm-hmm.
Conspicuous forms, bright, colorful forms. And then a lot of people, once they kind of refine their skills a little bit, it becomes a game. Hey, let's go out and see how many birds we can identify. A game that sometimes can be competitive. A lot of people will take it even further if they want, and it becomes actually an intellectual pursuit and even a scientific pursuit. Now, when you say scientific pursuit, we're not saying that you have to be a professional paid, but I can attest, having been a professional ornithologist, some of the most knowledgeable people about birds in the state of Alaska are not paid professional ornithologists. They're amateurs. And like I said, they've taken their skills and their interest to a much higher level, where, like I said, they've gone to become, it's evolved from just purely birders to ornithologists
mm-hmm.
with a scientific interest with even systematic a systematic pursuit.
Yeah, because the at the core of it at birding, when you're out there in the woods, at the core of all of that is simple observation. which is very much at the center of most of the way we sort of do science, for lack of a better term. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that process of observing out there, the things that you're paying attention to. And I'm sure it depends on where you're at, what you're looking for, or maybe that's not even the right mindset. Maybe it's not about going out and specifically looking for something. It's more about just being open to what's happening and picking things out as they occur.
For sure. You are being open. I mean, of course, we all have our biases, even as birders, like, you know, we'll go to a certain habitat and we'll expect to hear certain species. But a lot of times, especially during the migratory period, which we are in now, which is very exciting for birders,
mm-hmm.
and for non-birders alike, there'll always be that serendipity where, oh my gosh, we just saw this. I never expected to see that here. And that really, really fuels a lot of people's interest in birding, because there's always that serendipitous moment where you go, wow, just like a beautiful sunset sometimes, where you're like, that was just fantastic. I'm so glad we came here. Can you imagine if I had turned my back, I might have missed that or something like that.
Yeah.
And
In the blink of an eye, in the flap of a feather.
Right.
Well, I want to. That's a good way to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's going on Friday, with the shorebirds coming through right now. Of course, you know, this is the time of year for this, because there are those migratory birds coming through in such great numbers, and on Friday there are some dedicated times at the Kenai and Kasiloff Flats, some hot spots there, and maybe you could talk a little bit about those spots in particular and what they have to offer in terms of viewing birds and what folks could see, and maybe the differences between the two, or maybe there aren't a whole. Are there a lot of differences between what you would see near the mouth of the Kenai in those flats, and what you would see a little bit farther down the road in Kasiloff?
Yes. I mean, there's definitely much overlap, but there's a lot of times it's one place may have a little better diversity, or one may have a little bit better abundance of a particular species.
Okay.
But as far as the Kenai Flats hotspot, that, like I said, that's Friday, 2 to 3:30 p.m. And that'll be at the end of Cannery Road, what becomes Bow Picker and Sea Catch.
Mm-hmm.
There's a pond there by Inlet Seafoods. And that hosts a nice diversity and array of waterfowl and also shorebirds. Now, immediately after that hotspot, there will be one at the Kasiloff Flats down at the Kasiloff River from the north side, where you come down the beach access road as if you're going to go dip netting from the north side.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a team of birders, Chet Vincent and Laura Burke, and I believe John Trent also will be hosting birders. Now there, the mouth of the Kasiloff is renowned for its mud flats, a very high productivity. Now, the mouth of Kenai has mud flats that attract shorebirds, but it appears that the Kasiloff one has more forage for because it seems to host greater amounts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also more accessible in the sense that you can just drive right down to it. But they'll be going down there and when the tide is coming in, and just at the right moment before the shorebirds, they're concentrated, and then the mudflats are covered, and then they disperse. So they've timed this so that they'll be there right at the peak moment. And it is, you do want to be there at the right time, because that, a lot of times that serendipitous moment is at a particular time, or if it's going to occur, it's going to be in that time. But they've seen some great birds over the past years. I mean, some rare birds that we seldom get at this time of year in this particular place, or we get them in such small numbers that they're easy to miss. Like last year, they had killdeer and bar-tailed godwit, again, migratory shorebirds.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not unusual for them on a good day to get a dozen, even 15 different species of shorebirds. And I'm sure most people don't even realize that we have that many around here.
I certainly didn't. I saw, you know, I see some of these things happen peripherally and you know, through Facebook and some of those things. And speaking of in Kasiloff, Western Sandpipers, I saw, again, on Facebook is an interesting place to figure out where people are seeing stuff. It's kind of fun to follow along a little bit. But that's a number, I saw that number of like 400 Western Sandpipers counted down there like a week or two ago. And so the abundance thing down there is pretty impressive. And I noticed that you mentioned getting a specific time to get people to a specific area. It sounds like that's a great way to make sure people get a lot of photo opportunities.
Oh, yes. Yes, because sometimes, and it depends, it's you know, because of the concentration of shorebirds, there's also, they attract predators. Like there's merlins down there and the occasional peregrine falcon. And sometimes they will disperse the flock, you know, but that can be a show in itself.
Yeah.
When you see these powerful predators come in and do their thing, preying on shorebirds. But again, you know, even when I mentioned, you know, you might be lucky and see a dozen or 15 species. I mean, in the course of a year, you know, we'll see 40 different shorebird species, just shorebird species in our area. And I think some people are shocked, at least beginning people who have just maybe, you know, novices or beginning knowledge of birds, mm-hmm. that they're floored by the diversity and the numbers of species. Even if you go for a walk through the woods where you might detect 3 or 4 species, an expert will detect 20 or 30.
Right, and that's something that that we have spoken about in the past. Again, Toby Burke joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation. We're talking about the Kenai Peninsula Birding Festival, 14th annual, coming up this weekend. Actually, kind of kicking off today with the opening of the Peeps Youth Art Exhibit at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center, and more events planned for tomorrow and on through the weekend. And we're touching on some of those. Of course, that full list of events, we'll have that available on our website and links to other information regarding the bird festival at our website as well. But we've talked in the past, Toby, about that diversity and how that has changed a little bit over the years. It's you will see, for folks who have been at it for a while, there is a more diverse set of species to see now than there was maybe 20 or 30 years ago, and that's been kind of interesting to see develop.
Yeah, and for the most part, that can be attributed to two different factors. One, our climate has become more temperate,
mm-hmm.
and as our climate becomes more temperate, we get more temperate species breeding up here or at least frequenting the area than we have in the past. I mean, I can name several species that just say in 1970 didn't exist here, so just say a generation ago,
yeah.
that today are fairly commonplace, just like in particular some feeder birds that people might take for granted,
such as
a red-breasted nuthatch.
Mm-hmm.
They were not here in 1970. Now, not only are they here, they're common. They're ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
Steller's jay, northwest crow, brown creeper, ring-necked duck. These are all species that you would not have seen in this area. And the other thing I don't want to sidestep, there's you know, our climate becoming more temperate. But the other thing is our area is becoming more developed.
Right.
Dare I say, I know people here don't want to admit to it, but dare I say urbanized. But urbanization itself alters... And not always negatively. There can be positive aspects, mm-hmm. if you're looking at diversity. People tend to beautify their yards and workplaces with exotic plantings. These exotic plantings tend to bring in and even concentrate sometimes exotic species or what were once exotic species that are becoming, you know, more frequent here.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because with that... Is it kind of a slow burn sort of a thing where as the climate is doing what it's doing, changing a bit, it expands the range of where these birds can go. And so they might not just show up overnight in great numbers and lay down roots here. But one year they're here and the next year, well, gosh, we saw a couple of those. And then a few years later, you see a few more. And it kind of builds on that a little bit.
Right. And you're exactly right that it's not usually a revolutionary change. It's usually a small and sometimes, yes, almost an imperceptible change where some people may say, well, gosh, I've lived here for 50 years and I didn't even realize that we didn't have them then. And then all of a sudden they're common now. Because like I said, over the course of, you know, 40 or 50 years, you went from we never see them to that now they're common. But like I said, it's been a slow change.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked a little bit about some of the differences between just a few miles apart, between what you might see near the Kasilof River mouth in terms of shorebirds and then versus Kenai. I would be remiss if we didn't mention, you know, the Kachemak Bay Shorebird Festival is going on right now as well. Are there major differences between this part of the peninsula and down there? Does that sort of different ecosystem down around Kachemak Bay really influence the species that are attracted to that area and concentrate there?
Sure. I just will bring up that the Kachemak Bay Shorebird Festival was last week.
Was last week. My apologies.
So that was last week. So they don't overlap. But down in Kachemak Bay, they have... As people well know, like our waters, let's think about the inlet here, that we have that the glacial waters that are kind of murky. Down there, they have more blue water, clear water. And so they do have more maritime species.
Interesting.
And, of course, we excel. We have more boreal species, more of the inland, classic inland Alaska species. So we do have species that, like, you're more likely to see, just say, seabirds like a murre, a puffin, things of that sort. Where we're up here, you're more likely to find the olive-sided flycatcher and a black-backed woodpecker or three-toed woodpecker that you would not be likely to find or rarely find down there.
Mm-hmm. As long as we're into some specific species, my co-host here at KDOL, Jay Barrett, had a specific question. And again, if you have any questions about birding on the Kenai, 283-8414 is the number. We would love to have you in on the conversation this morning. Jay Barrett asking about Bohemian waxwings. They are his favorite bird, he says. And maybe you could talk. I know that they are between here and Kodiak in some capacity, but...
They're fairly widespread in boreal Alaska, which is the heart and soul of Alaska, and of course, which we have a lot of habitat here at the Kenai Peninsula.
Right.
They breed here, but they breed in relatively scattered, most birds when they're breed, they're not necessarily colonial, so you'll just have a bird here and a bird there that's breeding, and so they're easy to not detect. In fact, some people will not see them much at all during the breeding season. But come winter, they concentrate, and once the weather gets cold, they tend to head into town, and they're frugivores. They love fruit, and they will be feeding in your mountain ash trees and your choke cherry trees. And that's when most people notice them, when they say, oh my gosh, this flock of 50, 100, even 500 birds just descended into my yard or into, Leif Hansen Park, and just, what are those birds? Like, they're Bohemian waxwings.
And they come down, like, just as a flock like that.
Yes, and it's like this phenomena. And of course, it could be this frenzied feeding for a minute or two, and whether a predator chases them on, or they're just off to the next feeding site or to roost. But usually, like I said, it's this frenzied feeding. And I think that attracts a lot of people locally because they're going, oh my gosh, especially a winter landscape here, which sometimes may seem bird poor. And, sometimes our winter landscape seems almost lifeless. But then all of a sudden, boom, 100 or 300 Bohemian waxwings just descend on an area and just feed like mad. And people are kind of like shocked.
Yeah, that's a very much a sort of a behavioral phenomenon that attracts people's attention. That interests me because are there other species that have some sort of really unique kind of behavioral pattern that attracts folks out to try to see them, to try to see the birds doing their sort of specialized thing, whatever that might be?
Well, one thing, of course, during the migratory period, especially in spring, there's a lot of birds that are all of a sudden concentrated, like, for example, the Kenai Flats, you want to go, people want to go down there and they want to see the concentrations of waterfowl and geese, mm-hmm. that aren't necessarily breeding there, but are all of a sudden feeding like mad. And then, they might be there for a day or two or even a week or two, and then boom, they're gone. And so we'll have, again, these phenomenal concentrations, and then boom, it's, they're gone, not to be seen again
for another year. Yeah.
But as far as behavior, you were talking about another aspect. I mean, everyone talks about, like, the dance of the cranes, the nuptial, the courtship dance of the cranes, and as most species do have some type of nuptial, a ritual,
yeah.
nuptial behavior, a courtship behavior.
Yeah, and that's, those are things that that I have to imagine sort of come with time and spent outside observing things, is that's not probably for the beginner, not necessarily something that you're after necessarily, but after you've been around a particular species for a while and seen them in their habitat sort of doing their thing, those are things that you begin to pick out and you can see those little nuances for individual species. Yeah,
I agree, because like I said, with as far as like birding, like a lot of skills, you're refining them, and in the beginning you might be just checking off species, you're just looking to identify and put a name on a species. But later on, kind of when you've already cleared that hurdle and you're confident in your ideas, and we say, okay, I want to delve a little bit deeper, I just noticed this bird, it tends to nest here or whatever habitat it uses. And then again, a lot of people will go out in the field and note behaviors. For their own edification.
Yeah, you know? Again, it's that that observation component of it that leads you to be able to refine your search a little bit. I know that in this type of weather, they don't like it, and in that type of weather, they do like it. So I'm going to go to this sort of an area in this kind of a weather, and that will increase my chances if I want to see this particular thing.
Right, and that's the other aspect about maybe some of these guided tours. Is like, just for example, with George and Bev Kirch, you may walk down, like I said, a wooded trail, and you might see 1, 2, 3, 4 species of birds. Well, they're going to go out down the trail, and they're not just seeking to detect birds by eye, but by ear also. And actually, by ear, they'll detect more species usually than they'll detect by eye. So that's how some of these people, where you say, well, I walked down this trail, and I saw 4 species, and they'll walk down the trail and they'll get 15, 20, 30 because they're seeing with their eyes and they're seeing with their ears also.
That is a perfect segue. This is something that we did. If any of you remember, we did a very similar program to this last year about this time, and called up some bird sounds, and Toby was a fun sport with it last year. Maybe you'd like to try your luck again. And some of these, I think a couple of these are, I probably have recycled from my list last year, but a couple of these I know are new. And I'm going to start off actually with one that you mentioned earlier as being a species that did not used to commonly be here, but is found here much more often now. You use the term ubiquitous, so maybe everyone will recognize this one.
And that's the red-breasted nuthatch. And a lot of times we'll put, you know, mnemonics to help us. And so a lot of times people will describe that as yank, 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 yank.
That's a really interesting part of getting into birding is how you, as you say, you try to break that down into something that we can sort of spell out and recognize visually and auditorily. And that's interesting to try to put a human sort of context into what those calls and what those songs are. Let's try another one. Let me see if I can. First, I need to open this up all the way. Let's see here. This would be. Oh yeah, this is a good one.
Well, actually, there's a couple of birds. There was a snipe. A Wilson snipe in the background, but these sound like possibly Arctic terns.
Very good.
So, you know, people may, again, if they were to drive down to a city dock, especially this time of year, sometimes there'll be 30, 40, 50, even up to 200 of them sitting on the bank of the river near the parking lot.
And what do those look like?
They're a small bird, thin-winged, sharp little bill, and they're actually, like I said, they're a fairly small bird, slightly bigger than a robin, and they'll be fishing for small fish right there along the banks of the river, and sometimes they'll be sitting quietly, and then other times they can make, if you get enough of them, they'll make quite a racket.
Yeah. But, as we just heard, yeah, and that's again, that gets back to that idea of this being a place where such big concentrations of birds happen that you can really hear what they're talking about.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to bring up, just because I think it might be fun for people to know, or they say, oh yeah, been there, done that, is, you know, we all describe things differently because, as you know, we also hear things differently. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, like, I know some friends, like, for example, a northern saw-whet owl. When I hear it, I describe it's called, you know, it tends to go toot, 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 toot. So I say, oh, well, you know, you hear this bird going toot, 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 toot. And I know other people, they go, oh, no, it doesn't. It goes beep, 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 beep. And so, you know, we'll have these arguments like, oh, my gosh, it doesn't sound anything like that. So, and you'll get these disagreements among, you know, friends and people who have many years of birding, and they're like, oh, it doesn't sound. So we'll get these descriptions, even whether it's descriptions of, you know, visual descriptions or, you know, auditory descriptions, where we're like, oh, my gosh, the bird doesn't look like this. It looks like this. Oh, the bird doesn't sound like that. It sounds like this. So sometimes when you get people arguing. It's just the way that we all perceive and describe things differently.
Right. Yeah, very much so. And that's, again, getting back to that idea of how we sort of break down these sounds for ourselves to be able to describe them without being able to faithfully reproduce a sound that a bird makes. There's a lot of room for interpretation there. We are we're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take just a quick break. I'm going to grab a little bit of coffee. I hope you will stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll probably listen to a few more different bird calls. We'll get through the rest of the list. So much stuff going on this weekend with the Kenai Peninsula Birding Festival. Again, Toby Burke joining us this morning to talk us through the 14th annual Kenai Peninsula Birding Festival happening this weekend all over the central Kenai Peninsula. We'll get some more details on that coming up in the second half of the program, but hope you'll stay with us. We're going to take a quick break right now. And welcome back to the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran, joined this morning in the studio with Toby Burke. We are talking all about the 14th annual Kenai Peninsula Birding Festival coming up this weekend. Kicking off tomorrow, the big Kenai River float trip, always a fun one. Sold out, of course, already, but Centennial Park Walk in Soldotna tomorrow morning from 8 to 11 a.m. with a guided tour there with George and Bev Kirsch. And then festival introductions tomorrow evening at the Kenai Visitor Center at 6:30 with a lot more stuff going on all through the weekend. Of course, we mentioned it a little bit on Friday. There's going to be some guides out at the hot spots on the Kenai Flats and the Kasila Flats. And Toby, I wanted to talk a little bit about a piece of... Well, you've got it's called the Checklist of Birds on the Kenai Flats. Pretty self-explanatory, and this is something that you've kind of developed over the years. And walk us through this a little bit. I'm impressed at just how many different species you can see at a different time of year. It's a lot.
Yeah, the current checklist has, I believe, 194 species. And again, most people are floored when they hear the numbers of birds. And for the entire Kenai Peninsula, we're talking about a checklist that I've helped compile. You know, it's up to, I believe, around 315 species. So a lot of people are just amazed by that because they tend to think of the 5, 10, maybe 15 species that they see around their yard, and that kind of becomes their world, where they think like, okay, well, there might be 30 or 40 species that they might be able to put a name on. But like I said, just the Kenai Flats, and we're talking an area of about 7,500 acres. You know, 194 species have been documented. You know,
what is it? What I want to break this down a little bit. What does it take to officially document a bird having officially been in a place?
Well, a lot of times, you know, it's really in many ways been simplified, and you know, with this digital age, you know, if you were to take a picture of this mystery bird, or maybe a bird that you actually know is not likely to have occurred here before. Like, for example, you know, my wife photographed last year, a Say's Phoebe on the Kenai Flats. But she photographed it, you know, and, you know, any layperson could photograph it and then send it to, you know, myself, or someone in the Kenai Birding Club. They could send it to a person with the refuge, professional biologist. And mm-hmm. a lot of times, one or another, if they can't identify it, they'll send it either up the line to an expert. And then, generally speaking, people are like, oh, you're right. We did confirm this is such and such a species. Like, for example, a Say's Phoebe. Then, you know, we put that on the list. But just to let you know, that 194 species, I mean, those encompass the sightings of many, many people over the course of the last 50 years.
Yeah.
So it's not, no one person has, I mean, I've been fortunate enough, I live near the flats. I've seen about 180 of those 194, but there's still, you know, but like I said, you know, Ken Tarbox, a lot of Chet Vincent, you know, I can't even name all the people who contributed to that with their documented sightings. I'd do an injustice by not including all the people who have help put this together. It's been dozens of people who contributed their sightings with systematic records. I mean, a lot of times their own personal data.
Yeah. And that's one reason why we continue to see, I mean, 14th year in a row, and we continue to see more and more folks showing up for the Kenai Peninsula Birding Festival every year. I think it probably has a lot to do with the fact that here locally, full-time residents are interested in these things and do keep track of these things. And so there are a lot of resources here. You mentioned some of the guided tours that are done by folks who just, this is their hobby, but After you do it for a long time, by gosh, you've really educated yourself very specifically in a pretty specialized area.
Sure. I mean, we have people, you know, who are accountants and doctors, or for example, and other people like who are fisheries biologists. I mean, Ken Tarbox and George Kirsch. I mean, they're fisheries biologists.
Right.
So that was the way they made a living. But on, you know, as a hobby, that probably became more than a hobby. You know, they became experts in bird identification and behavior and self-taught ornithologists.
I wanted to move ahead a little bit on the schedule of events for the weekend, because Saturday is Friday is a big day, but Saturday is like really jam-packed with stuff. And of course, we have to mention the Big Sit. This is a really neat event that, if folks don't know, it's 24 hours of kind of shifts and posting up at different places, and just how many different species can you identify over the course of 24 hours. And talk a little bit about that event and some things that you've seen over the years with that.
Yeah, the 24-hour Big Sit, it begins at 6 a.m. on Saturday, and it goes through all the way to 6 a.m. on Sunday. And there'll be a few, you know, at least one guide at all times up there, so people can stop by during that period and bird with us. Or if they have any questions, any birds they want identified, we can help them put a name to a bird. But we'll be up there for 24 hours. This will be the sixth year in a row that we've had this event, and like I said, we'll have coverage around the clock. And you know, our best year, one year, actually it was our very first year, we had 70 species. A more average number would be, you know, 50, 55.
Mm-hmm.
I think last year we had 64, which was above average. But generally speaking, we're expecting to see somewhere between 50 and 70 species just in one spot, meaning we're stationary. And a Big Sit is supposed to be what they say, just what it sounds like, where we sit and watch. But because of the richness of that area, you know, if I did a Big Sit in the back of my yard right now, you know, I might get 25 species, if I was lucky, 30. But like I said, if I go down to sit at the flats, it's realistically I could get 70.
Because that's such a dynamic area right there.
Yes,
yeah,
it is. And there's a reason why a bird platform, or I shouldn't even just say bird, there's a reason why a wildlife platform, a viewing platform, was placed there.
Yeah, because you can, any time of year, you can go down and not necessarily guaranteed to see something, but most times you'll see something.
Oh, yeah. We're either seeing beluga whales, we're seeing caribou,
yeah,
we're seeing coyotes running across the flats. Besides the birds. You know?
Yeah, no, that's a great resource right there for sure. And the Big Sit is interesting because I know that the way that you're looking for stuff, I mean, of course, we've got plenty of daylight even in the middle of the night right now at this time of year. But at night, you're looking for and especially listening for different things than you would be during the daytime hours. Or at least that would be my assumption.
Sure. I mean, we're listening for owls, and there's a lot of animals that are, you know, crepuscular, where a lot of times they're most active when the light is fading or right before it gets dark. So those shoulder periods, you know, tend to be periods of great activity for certain species, for sure.
Yeah, and bird photography basics, that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm curious, are you more, Toby, are you more of a photographer, or do you like to just take the scope out and just observe and keep those mental memories?
I'm renowned for not being a photographer. My wife does
that. Was a bit of a loaded question.
Yeah, my wife does all the documentation. But I will say, I think most people nowadays as birders, I would say I'm in the minority. Most people want to have that keepsake photograph or at least capture an image and then later put a name to it. And they may be able to put a name to itself. You know, they may go home, look it up on the internet, or they may go home and look at a field guide and go, oh, that's a greater yellowlegs. Before, I just knew it was a shorebird. But a lot of times, with all the resources out there, not to mention apps, people can, you know, birding apps, they can use their iPhone and put an identification right there at that spot themselves.
Yeah. I don't want to put you on the hook for endorsing anything in particular, but along those same lines, are there online tools or some modern tools that you use that you would suggest folks maybe take a look at that have helped you in that way? Do you have an app on your phone?
I guess one thing that I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, you know, as far as among the birding community, and then that's evolved over the last dozen or more years, is Cornell University has eBird.
Yes.
And you can access that over your iPhone. But they have ID resources, and they also provide checklists, area checklists, which will show you what you're likely or unlikely to see in a particular area. So that may help you, hone, as far as limit, what the possibilities for IDs. But eBird is basically this wonderful program that Cornell started that's really harnessed the power of citizen science.
Yeah, that's, and I should mention, because you brought it up, I should mention that some of the bird sounds we played a little bit earlier, I got from Cornell University, from their archive. They have a great archive of pretty much all things birding. Yeah, it's a really neat, it's a really great resource.
Right, and like I said, a lot of these began with professional ornithologists making recordings, but now, again, where you had dozens or hundreds of ornithologists, you now literally have thousands, tens of thousands of birders that far outnumber professionals and really yeah. provide far, far more data and much more power to power models and develop checklists and things of that sort.
Yeah, the power of big data as applied to the birding world, I'm sure, is has got to have been an impressive development over, say, what, the last decade?
Yes, and it's essentially provided a quantum leap.
Yeah.
For birding and ornithology.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of cool stuff going on. And I wanted to get to another event coming up on Saturday during the festival is a walk in the woods, and that's out along Funny River Road, and that's an interesting area. And I did this walk a few years back. That's an interesting area because, of course, not too long ago, that area sustained a massive wildfire. And so that a huge and dramatic landscape change like that is something interesting because that will offer you a lot of different opportunities to see different things that you might not ordinarily see in that spot.
Right, and that event is from 1:30 to 3 p.m. on Funny River Road on the old woodcutting road of the refuge. It's mm-hmm. usually a gated road, and people will park there, and then they'll walk up that road. So you don't have to hike through the brush. It'll be along the road. But like I said, that area, a portion of that area was incinerated by the 2014 Funny River fire, and Cindy Avery will be guiding there, and because of the road, you will have pretty good view sheds, and they're likely to encounter woodpeckers in the yep. dead timber, and also a lot of people don't realize, but a lot of times after a fire, the areas will start to attract a variety of flycatchers.
Oh, is that right?
Right.
And that's because of all that breaking down of things. There's just a lot more probably insect and bug life there. So that probably it's a pretty rich dining room as a lot of that area is sort of breaking down.
Yes, yes. And not that, but then there's also whether people, will start to realize there'll be the regrowth in the underbrush, small vegetation, trees, brush, bushes and forbs coming up.
Yeah.
But depending on the stage, how many years after, it'll attack different types of and different proportions of flycatchers, especially as we get further along, especially into June.
Yeah, when the bugs really start getting right, thick. Exactly. Yeah. And then moving on to Saturday evening, of course, a keynote speaker is a part of this event every year. And this year it's George Matz, and he'll be speaking, as I've got it here in front of me, monitoring the Kenai Peninsula's spring shorebird migration. And George has been a part of the birding community in the state of Alaska for a long, long time. But what are you looking forward to with George's keynote, Toby?
Well, George moved down, he resided in the past in Anchorage and then, before that Fairbanks and later Anchorage. And he moved down to the Kenai full-time in 2004. And he's immersed himself into the bird life of the Kenai Peninsula. He had questions about shorebirds in his own mind, especially in the Kachemak Bay area, and he initiated this study down there. And not just himself, he's recruited dozens of other local amateur ornithologists. This is not run by paid professionals from agencies. Don't get me wrong, they do work in concert with them and they do share data. But locally, even our Kenai birders, our Kenai Birder Club has joined the Kachemak Bay Birders, and we're now monitoring, in a concerted effort, the shorebirds up in our area, particularly at the Kisilov River mouth. But I think George's talk is going to I think it will also talk about, again, the power of citizen science, the power of not only that, but how people who aren't paid professionals, who aren't classically trained biologists, how they can make meaningful contributions to not just the conservation of birds locally, but also that they can basically perform hardcore science.
Yeah.
They can be part of it, you know, and I think George is going to talk about that. I think he'll probably talk about the whole evolution, how we went from an idea to an effort that now involves dozens of people on the peninsula.
You know, in talking about how magnified that power is when you get, you know, millions of eyeballs looking and studying something. Something that's happened in Kenai here over the last year that's been really popular is the Kenai Eagle's Nest Cam, City of Kenai Eagle's Nest Cam. And that's another venue where you can, for not very much cost, you know, an organization, be it a university or a municipality, whatever, can put up some little device, and then people from all around the world can be observing this thing and taking notes on it and keeping track on it and gathering all sorts of data and analyzing it sort of in real time. And I'm curious, do you think that's a good thing? Should there be more, you know, eagle cams and more ways for people to observe these things? Or does that just lead you down kind of that slippery slope of exposing it to, maybe, I don't want to say too many people, but there are those areas where, and we see it on the Kenai all the time, where things are, you know, sort of loved to death is a common phrase. So is there a tipping point there, or is there room for a lot more of that sort of thing?
I think its primary benefit is that it does raise the consciousness of people who maybe would otherwise not be conscious of either the eagles around them or the life cycles or what what their needs are, you know, whether it comes to habitat, space, quiet, things of that sort. So I think ultimately it is beneficial. And actually the cameras themselves, the birds usually become inured to it. I mean, they just eventually it becomes part of the surroundings. So it actually, I think, can prevent disturbance. People saying, I don't have to get close to this nest because I can see into the nest or get a better view than if I just get online and look at it, and I don't have to disturb this bird. So I think it can actually save the birds from unneeded disturbance.
And I think you don't have to look really all that far, even here within the state, to see how access in that way can really get a public force behind a conservation effort. You look just to Katmai Park and the bears in Katmai National Park and how popular those bear cams are, right, and how much more support there is probably for keeping that area pristine and wild and natural the way it is, that maybe probably wasn't there 20 years ago because folks just couldn't see it. Now they can see it, and it becomes this real thing for them. Yeah.
Right. They're aware of it. They're conscious about it, and they start to care about it. Where before, like I said, it's like, you know, out of mind, out of sight, out of mind.
Out of sight, out of mind, yeah, yeah. And so getting out there and getting some walks is very important. And that brings me to just kind of wrapping this up on Sunday, a few more walks happening on Sunday for folks too.
Yes, again, you know, Bev and George Kirsch are actually conducting morning walks on Thursday, on Friday, on Saturday, and on Sunday. So
they're getting their miles in.
Yes, and you know, each walk that they're conducting is in a different place, different habitat, and some of them, there'll be some overlap, but there'll be probably some unique species that you wouldn't necessarily see on a previous walk. And so they've deliberately chosen these four different areas. And and again, all these events, you know, we haven't necessarily covered all of them, or maybe I'm saying a person wants a more detailed description,
yeah,
than what I've provided here. You know, they can get on the Kenai Birding Festival Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the Facebook page there, you can look on the Kenai Cultural Center website, and there'll be links to get you to the right place where you can get all the dates, the times, the places, and even a lot of times who the guide is going to be.
Yeah.
And even some of the birds that you might see.
Yeah, yeah, all this stuff pretty readily available, and we'll have links to all those things on our website as well at kdll.org. And you know, as we get down to just kind of the last few minutes, gosh, it's blown by already again this hour. I'm curious for you, Toby, is there anything this year specifically that you're keeping an eye out for, or that you've heard whispers of there being around that you haven't seen before, anything like that, any new developments in the birding world?
Let me think about that. I mean, as far as, like I said, you know, there's always that serendipity. Every season is always different. Like, for example, every year that we do the big sit, there's new birds that we haven't seen on that event. Every time we do the flow trip, there's new birds that we haven't seen. I'm sure if you were to talk to George and Bev, if you, you know, when you look back on their four, there's probably every year there's a species that they haven't detected in previous years, you know, in all the cumulative walks they've done. So every year we're still seeing birds. Like I said, even though I tell you, like on the float trip, you know, you might see 60, possibly 70 species on the Kenai River float trip. Well, in all the years that we've been doing it, we've had a cumulative lift of over 105.
Is that right?
And the big sit, you know, even though I say, well, we might see 50, possibly 70 species, well, the cumulative list for that event is almost 100 species. Wow. And every year, you know, there's, as you can imagine, it gets harder to add a new bird, but new birds keep getting added for, and you know, that's just kind of the law of averages, I'm sure. But so every year we're seeing stuff that we haven't seen before. But it doesn't always just have to be about seeing a new species. I know birders can get fixated on that.
Yeah.
A lot of times, you know, I was telling my wife this one year where I was out birding and this flock of marbled godwits flew by and the sun, and they're a cinnamon colored bird. And then the sun was shining on them, you know, from behind me. So they were backlit and they just looked just absolutely beautiful and golden. Now I'd seen them many, many times before, but that moment is fixated in my mind. I'm saying that was one of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen. Even though I'd seen these birds many, many times before, it's just like this flock of about a dozen birds backlit, and you know, the type of thing where all the people around me, there was just this hush and everyone's jaws fell, you know, fell open, and when the birds passed, everyone just looked at each other and said, oh my gosh, was that amazing or what? You know.
And that's why a camera isn't always necessary, right?
Right. I think most people there would, like I said, we were just stupefied, and then later on people go, oh, I didn't even take a photo of that.
I wanted to again, just a couple minutes left, I wanted to bug you about that a little bit. Is it a conscious decision to kind of leave the camera off to the side and just observe and take it in? Or just, you never bothered with the camera, so why start now?
For me, yes, it is a conscious decision. In fact, you know, I can say actually, you know, I get a little bit of derision from some people because they're like, well, you saw this great bird, but you didn't photograph it. And I'm going, oh, it's not a selfish act as much as a lot of times I want to be unencumbered. Like I have my binoculars, I might even have my scope. That's enough for me to be carting around. You know, my wife will take a camera, you know, and she'll do that part where a lot of times she'll be trying to get this beautiful photo and I'm on to the next bird. But I know of other birders, and they're not always just older birders like me, you know, I'm in my 50s, but I know some other birders that are in their 20s and 30s that are, you know, tech savvy, and they go, you know, they love going out there and just having this organic experience where they're unencumbered. They have their optics, their little pair of binoculars. But other than that, they just want to be strolling. And they don't want to have the pressure to document something or photograph. And they just go, it's just good enough that I saw the bird. You know, if it's nice, I'll share the sightings so someone else might want to go down and find this bird. But, you know, they just want to be unencumbered. They like that freeness, that feeling of, you know, freedom.
Just getting off of the cell phone for a minute, and not every moment needs to go straight to Instagram.
Exactly.
Well, that perhaps could be a whole nother hour in and of itself, but we'll save that for another time. We're just about out of time, Toby, but is there anything else that folks ought to know about the festival coming up this week and anything that we missed or that you would really steer folks
toward? Yeah, every day
toward?
Is packed. I guess we should mention the Peeps Art Show for sure on Friday evening.
Always a lot of fun.
You know, 6:30 to 7 p.m. And then, like I said, after the art show, there's a special visitor. So that evening really, really is definitely a family-focused evening. You know, there's something for the adults, but most especially there's something for the kids. Like I said, between the art show and the local visitor who is feathered. And so those tend to be events that are really, really popular with the kids, and that mom and dad should really bring the kids out to enjoy.
All right. That and many other things happening this weekend for the 14th annual Kenai Birding Festival. And again, we'll have links and information at our website. Get you to everywhere you want to be this weekend to see all the pretty and fun birds. Toby Burke joining us this hour. Thank you so much, Toby, for coming in. Always a fun time to have you in and talk a little bit about the birding world.
And thank you for inviting me in and the festival. We really enjoy doing this.
All right, great. Well, good luck with the festival this weekend. We'll have our fingers crossed for some great weather and hope everybody gets to see what they came to see.